Hello, everybody, and welcome. I get to welcome you to this wonderful event. My name is Dan Mortensen. I'm the chair of one of the presenting organizations, the Audio Engineering Society. And if you want to know more about our activities, here's our website down at the bottom of this thing here, and we have meetings periodically. We're real excited to be co-sponsoring this with the physics department and some others who you'll hear from. Physics is real important to what we all do, and we're looking forward to doing things in the future, I hope, with you. I wanted to tell you about our future, though. We have meetings once a month that are free and open to non-members and members as well. On April 25th, we have a presentation called When Timing Audio for Video Becomes Impossible, also known as The Impossible Will Take a Little Longer. And that'll be up in Bothell at Opus 4 Studio, presented by Mike Metesky, and it's about audio for video. In May, we're not quite certain what our meeting is going to be, but I think it's going to be a presentation about what it's like to be an acoustician and what's involved in that, and that'll be to be announced. On June 21st, we'll be meeting at Shoreline College, and Ron Jones, or Steve, who has an awesome scoring studio facility up in Stanwood, will talk with us. Composer for Family Guy, the TV show. And it's in a pretty amazing facility, apparently, and I think he's talking about that and what it's like doing that. And I wanted to thank our member, Gary Louie, who worked with the physics department to put this together. There was a lot of work put together by the physics group, and we're glad that they did that. And the last thing I'm going to say is that the next person to talk to you is from the Burke Museum.
Hello. I'm Katie Bunn-Marcuse, and I'm the curator of Native Art and the director of the Bill Holmes Center for the Study of Northwest Native Art at the Burke Museum. It's a lovely evening here in Coast Salish territory, and I just wanted to explain a little bit about why the Bill Holmes Center is helping to support Carl Haber's lecture this evening. Carl and his lab were instrumental in one of the projects that we have taken on at the Burke Museum, which is the digitization and republication of old 1930 films and audio done by Franz Boas with George Hunt and others in the village of the Kwakwaka'wakw community of Fort Rupert in 1930. And so I just really wanted to say thank you to Carl and everyone in the Irene Labs for the amazing amount of work they did on 24 of these old wax cylinders, some of which were broken and in bad shape, and they are really have done huge work to get those old songs back out and into use in community. So thank you very much.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us this evening for the public lecture. My name is Shi Jiexu, and I am an assistant professor in physics of University of Washington. I'm very pleased to have you here this evening. This event is presented by physics and co-sponsored by Audio Engineering Society Pacific Northwest Section and Bill Holmes Center for Burke Museum and Center for Digital Arts and Experimental Media, AKA DX Arts. Thanks for all of you for coming in and for supporting this event. When I was a Chamberlain Fellow at Berkeley before joining faculty in UW, Carl told me that physics research at the highest energy can help restore the oldest sound recording. I was thrilled. So I've been thinking about have Carl come to Seattle to share his invention with everyone. Now, this has come true. So, how the huge instrument which discovered the Higgs boson and can help the sound recording. This new approach to recovery in 19th and early 20th century, unplayable sound recording was developed. This approach used only light to read minute audio signals, which were captured as early as 1860 and render them audible. You are going to hear the oldest recorded American voice, and you are going to hear, quite possibly, the oldest playable recording of music in the world. I'm very happy to have Carl Haber here from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Yeah. He's an experimental physicist and received his PhD in physics in Columbia University. He is a senior scientist in the physics division of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory at University of California. His main research focus is in the development of instrumentation and methods for detecting and measuring particles created at high-energy colliders, such as the Large Hadron Collider at CERN near Geneva in Switzerland. He's a recipient of 2013 MacArthur Genius Grant and a fellow of the American Physical Society and of the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. We are very grateful for him making this trip this evening to enlighten us his invention. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Haber.
Good evening. Can you hear me okay? Thank you very much. I'm really honored and happy to be here. Thank you to the physics department, to the Burke Museum, to the Audio Engineering Society for this great invitation. As Shisha said, my work is in physics, and so I'm approaching the topic of audio and historic audio and the restoration of audio from the perspective of a physicist, and that's kind of the place I came from that kind of gave me entry into this subject, which has been so interesting and so rewarding in intellectually and academically. So let me try to motivate how, as physicists, we think about these problems and how that led us to studying early sound recordings. So this is a little vessel that's covered, and it's filled with a vapor that's very saturated, probably with alcohol. And in it is a pin, and the pin's radioactive, so it's emitting particles all the time. And every time it emits a particle, the vapor condenses along the tracks. And so we get this picture of all these little wispy patterns that are coming out. So just by looking at this picture, we know this pin is radioactive. And so this is a way that scientists use detectors, systems to turn physical phenomena into images, into things that we can directly visualize and start to ask questions about. Now, this is a kind of a very simple example, and in some ways not profound in that it's giving us some new insight into the world, but there have been many discoveries that have been made in science just by taking data, information out of images. So this one is the same kind of a process, but you can see there's just one line and it's curving in a particular way. That picture alone actually showed people and proved to people that a new kind of matter, which is called antimatter, actually exists. So this picture was taken, like say, in the late 1920s, and it established a profound discovery about the world. Okay, this picture, which is also of this same character, a little bit harder to understand, very complicated, and I won't try to explain it, but the mere existence of this single picture showed scientists that there was a very deep connection between certain forces of nature that were understood finally to be manifestations of the same kind of physical reality. So once again, pictures are really deep ways that we can learn about the world. This picture was taken by a great astronomer, Vera Rubin, who was measuring the way galaxies moved. And by imaging galaxies in a particular way and studying their spectra, she discovered that, or quantified, that much of the universe is made of a type of matter that we can't see, that doesn't give off any light, called dark matter. Again, pictures giving us this very direct information about the world. Finally, this is a picture that Crick and Watson eventually use to understand the structure of DNA. They're getting their data from pictures. So these are all pictures that were taken essentially with cameras and film. Now today, we use digital imaging. So pictures now become essentially big tables of numbers that can be manipulated on a computer, and we can ask very, very detailed questions about these pictures, and we can even do precise measurements of things that are going on. So these two pictures here are supposed to show that obviously some kind of facial recognition is being done, and in this case, some kind of biometric data is being extracted from an image. And today, with very sophisticated computer algorithms, we can apply automation and machine learning techniques to get information from pictures. And in fact, part of the reason I'm here today is because we're having a conference that Shishen colleagues organized called Connecting the Dots, which is about essentially using these modern methods to extract information from the pictures that are created in high energy physics type of experiments. And just to take this one little step further, I think I can make you appreciate how easily we can actually get interesting information from a picture. So this is a picture of a person jumping off a cornice. Unfortunately, it's my son, but he actually survived. But the question is, you know, where is he in this picture? Now, the answer is Vail, but more mathematically, you know, you might want to locate him inside the picture. So this picture, think of it as just a big table of numbers. Each pixel has a number in it, which is how much light there is at that point. Now, what you do is you take every single one of those points, and you take the eight that are around it, all right? And you do a very simple mathematical transformation. You just take the value that's in any one spot, you multiply it by 8, and subtract all the values around it, okay? And when you do that, this picture becomes that picture. Because what it's doing here, if you study calculus, it's taking a derivative of the picture, but it's basically just accenting all the places where the contrast changes a lot. So once the picture is in this form, we've eliminated almost all the kind of uninteresting stuff, and we can focus in exactly on the point of interest, and we can start to ask mathematical questions. If I had a sequence of these pictures, we could actually trace his trajectory in a very ready way. So this is meant to give you a notion of how important pictures are as ways of measuring things about the world. Now, around 2000, I was thinking about these issues quite a lot, and I was very excited and very impressed by the extent to which these kind of analyses could give us really meaningful information about things. And I was very fortunate to be listening to public radio, and I heard, it was a public affairs forum, like in California we have the Commonwealth Club, where they bring in people to speak about topics of public interest. And this particular forum, which was in 2000, was an interview with Mickey Hart. So he's a percussionist, originally in The Grateful Dead, but many other musical accomplishments, and a person who's also very, very committed to the subject of audio preservation. Okay, it's his passion, and he serves on panels for the government and the Library of Congress and various things, and he's written this book called Song Catchers, In Search of the World's Music, all about how important the audio legacy is. And so I was listening to this show, and you know, these are kind of the points that he made. Sound recordings are of great historical value. There are a lot of them, for example, at the Library of Congress. They can be damaged and delicate and endangered because they're old, they're falling apart, they've been mishandled and so forth. They're in a wide variety of formats, particularly as you go back in time, you get a lot of different ways that people recorded sound. And the systems to play these old recordings back are typically not even maintained in all cases. He actually codified all of this in a very interesting paper that he published in the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society in 2001, which is a preservationist plea to the audio community. And he talks about all of these issues. But listening to Mickey Hart's discussion on the radio and also thinking a lot about pictures and how important they were, as a scientific tool, kind of led me to this question. Could we turn a sound recording into a picture? Because if we could turn a sound recording into a picture, we could start to use the kind of tools and methodologies that, as physicists, we're using to do our measurements of particle characteristics and other things, or structures of proteins and so forth. And so, well, it's very early in the talk, so obviously the answer is going to be yes, or you know, I wouldn't have posed the question. Now, but it's really the journey that I took from this point, from this question, that I really want to try to share with you this evening. And as I went through this has been already more than 10 years, I really learned a lot of new things that I hadn't encountered, never thought I would ever encounter professionally or otherwise. But finally, I sort of put it into a list of kind of three different stories that I think are meaningful to keep in mind as we go through the discussion this evening. So the first sort of narrative that runs through this is how powerful it is to now apply the kind of quantitative methods that are available to us to humanities collections. Okay, and this is kind of a little motivated by just this picture. This is called the Digital Michelangelo Project. These are people who use 3D laser scanning to digitize the Michelangelo's David and then make it available online. You can rotate it, look at the parts that you like the best, and so forth. I'm not going to go there. But okay, so this is obviously just suggestive, but this is a very general thing and is increasingly powerful and important. The second story is that our culture and our history, as represented in recorded sound, is very important. And there are very interesting and important challenges to the preservation of, to the access to, and the restoration of these historical sound recordings. And the three pictures I chose to represent this here are, this is Leadbelly, who was discovered in prison, recorded by the Lomaxes, and then went on to a career as a recording artist. This is Melville Jacobs, who was here, I believe, at the University of Washington, who did early electrical recordings around the Pacific Northwest. And then finally, this is LBJ, who blessed us by recording all his phone conversations on plastic belts. And I invite you to find them online. They're fascinating. If you really want to get to know LBJ, listen to his phone conversations. And then finally, the third story that runs through this narrative is that sound recordings give us a very interesting window on the 19th century, which is a kind of heroic period of invention when you have people like Alexander Graham Bell or Thomas Edison, who are just these kind of wild individuals. They're not part of any kind of corporate entity. They're just doing what they want to do, not even from a strongly academic background. They're just inventing stuff. But interestingly, almost all the analog and digital, even digital concepts, which underlie the information-based world that we're in now, were first explored in some way in this heroic period and then morph into the things that we now consider. So when you start to explore historic sound recordings, you kind of run into all of these three narratives. Okay, so just to make sure everyone's on the same page, what is sound? So sound is a propagating periodic compression and rarefaction of matter. It's a wave that can travel through a gas like this room, through liquid, through solid, but not through a vacuum. So it's true in space, no one can hear you scream. And when you see a movie with a big explosion in space, that's not right. You can't hear it. The pitch or the tone of the sound has to do with the period of that wave, and that's just a kind of a cartoon here. And the volume is the excursion, the amplitude, the way the pressure varies from ambient. Okay? And the very important thing about sound, and obviously we would not be here sharing this story tonight, if sound could not be transferred from one place to another, so it's going from my mouth to the air here and into your ear and making your eardrum move and all of that. So sound can be transferred. And complex sounds, like an A major chord, you know, can be viewed, understood as a sum of simple tones that are added together. Mathematically, we would call this a waveform, and it's a measure of an amplitude, which is this direction, versus time, which is this direction. Okay? So what is a sound recording? Okay? So sound recording occurs when we can transfer this mechanical effect, this propagation through a medium, into a typically soft material and somehow permanently change that material in a way that corresponds to the propagation of sound. And there were two people that whose names have to be mentioned at the very outset of sound recording. So one is Léon Scott de Martinville, who's a French inventor who's working in the 1850s and 1860s, and the other is Thomas Edison. I'm sure everyone's heard of Thomas Edison. Not everyone has maybe heard of Léon Scott de Martinville. What Léon Scott de Martinville did is he built a machine that took a cone, a diaphragm, so something that could move under the absorption of sound, and a stylus, and he wrote sound onto a drum that was coated in lampblack, so it was covered with schmutz. And you know, you could inscribe the sound. So he wrote sound on paper, but because it was on paper, he couldn't play it back. So he had a sound recorder, but not a reproduction system. In 1877, Thomas Edison, apparently not influenced by Scott, unaware of Scott, does a very similar machine, a drum, but instead of paper, it's coated with tinfoil, and he has a diaphragm and a stylus, and Edison embosses sound on foil, and therefore was able to reproduce it because he could run the process in reverse and cause a diaphragm to move in sympathy with the embossed pattern that he put on. Okay? And this is the breakthrough, because now sound can be reproduced. Everybody wants to listen to what they had recorded. It gives rise to the commercial record business and all kinds of other applications of sound recording. But Léon Scott is really the first person to capture the world in real time. People had taken photographs, but nobody had actually captured the world in time as it was happening before Léon Scott did this phonautograph, phone self-writer machine. So when we now talk about what sound recording becomes after Scott and Edison sort of have their invention, is sort of two formats kind of proliferate for a while. One is the disc, which many of you are familiar with. Maybe you remember your grandparents had LPs or something, right? Okay. And the other is the cylinder, which is more obscure. Many people had probably never seen a cylinder. Others may be aware of them. But in both cases, there's a groove. In the case of the disc, the groove is an Archimedes spiral, so it's a groove of, say, fixed pitch that spirals inwards or outwards from an outer radius to an inner radius. And the sound is encoded in an excursion of the groove from its simple Archimedes trajectory. Okay? So the speed at which the rate at which it's changing is the pitch, and the amplitude, the amount of excursion is the amplitude. In the case of the cylinder, it's a helix that goes around and around the cylinder. And in this case, time is positioned along the helix, and amplitude is a radial in and out deviation from the surface. Okay? If you actually ask yourself the question, you know, how big are these structures, these deviations? It's remarkable, actually, how small they are, and how 100 years ago, there was more than 100 years ago, there was a technology that could actually systematically capture information in this way. So here's a cylinder. If you kind of zoom in on it, there's like a tiny little chunk, and you can see that little piece of that helical structure going up and down, up and down. Here, if we look on the disk, you can see that Archimedes spiral zoomed in, kind of wiggling from side to side. In the case of the disk, the sound is encoded in this side-to-side movement. The depth of the groove is about 75 microns. So that may not be a familiar unit. 50 microns, according to Wikipedia, is the average human hair. 50 microns. So this is a little bit bigger, 1.5 times the average human hair. And the groove is moving a fraction of that up to 75 or 100 microns, but as little as a fraction of a micron of movement encodes the sound on the disk. Instead, the cylinder, the helix, the groove is moving up and down, and it's only moving up and down on the scale of a couple of microns. The depth of the groove itself is only about 10 microns, and it's moving up and down by some fraction of that. These are very, very small numbers, but interestingly, if you take one of these disks and you just unwound it, it would be 150 meters long. So it's a huge structure considering how minute the variation is. So for scientists who want to measure these things, well, the phonograph playback system did a pretty good job of measuring these things and sending the signal back. But if I want to turn this into a picture, I'm going to need to get information on these very, very minute scales. So that's going to put like very, very strong constraints on the kind of microscopic measurements that I'm going to have to do. Okay? So the last thing that I kind of have to know in order to do this is, okay, suppose there is this pattern of undulations up and down, side to side, and I want to get information from it. What is the actual, say, mathematical relationship between this movement and the sound that I actually want to hear? Okay, so it turns out that if you analyze the way in which records were designed, they were meant to be played back with a needle called a stylus that you put in the groove, and there was a nice picture of one over here. But that needle wiggles around and causes a magnet to move in the vicinity of a coil. So if you've taken your freshman E&M, you know that that induction is at play here. So what's really going on is the sound, the signal that we actually read is not due to the shape of the groove, but actually the speed at which the stylus is moving. So we have to differentiate all this information to actually get at the sound. If we just measure the shape, we're getting at something that's related to the sound, but it's not quite right. And it turns out, for very different reasons, but a little more subtle, that before electromagnetic systems, the systems that Edison and Leon Scott used, which had diaphragms and styli, for other reasons, you get exactly the same mathematical relationship. The sound is the speed that the needle is moving, not its actual trajectory. And that turns out mathematically to be a very important distinction. So all of this leads to the idea of developing a non-invasive approach to restoring sound using pictures, right? Because we ask the question, same question, but phrased a little differently, could we optically digitize a recording without making any contact to the material? Because Mickey Hart told us that, you know, these records were very delicate and some of them were broken. So we want to avoid making contact with them. Could we then write a computer program that could process this image, like the one I wrote to take the picture of my son stupidly jumping off a cliff? Could we write a computer program to process the image and recover the sound? And if we could, we could basically tick off a whole bunch of things on Mickey Hart's list. We could restore, stabilize delicate or damaged media. We could access large numbers by using kind of modern automation and analysis techniques. We could get a lot of interesting information about the physical condition, which is typically very interesting to conservators and people in museums. And we could generalize and not have to worry about legacy playback systems. So back in 2003, we started to sort of systematically study all of this in what turned out to be a really great collaboration with folks at the Library of Congress who shared this interest. And I particularly want to mention Peter Allier, who still works at the Library of Congress and we still work with on this, but as well as Vitaly Fadeyev, who's a colleague now at Santa Cruz, and Earl Cornell, who works at Berkeley Lab with me. So the basic process that emerges from this idea and thinking it through is that we find some appropriate cameras, some appropriate tools for turning sound recordings into pictures, and I'll tell you a little more later what those are, but something. And we non-invasively, with no contact to the material, we scan the surface and we create lots of images, lots of slices of profiles of the surface, and we stack them up on top of each other and create a map, a huge map, gigabytes of data, but that images with hopefully sufficient precision this entire surface. Now we've got this image, right, and we archive it. It becomes a valuable artifact of this process. But then we pass this this image, this data set, through an algorithm that is designed, taking into account the distances and the differentiation and all of that, what I just talked about, to calculate the motion of not a real needle, but a virtual needle. What would a needle do if it was passing through this whole surface? And then apply restorative techniques, clean up dirt, scratches, and other things through algorithms. Finally, creating an audio waveform and then a wave file itself that we can use to access the material. So this is a kind of a comic or a cartoon of a process that we spent several years kind of figuring out how to do. That enabled us to get this kind of non-invasive but very inclusive access to this material. So there were two different techniques of, let's say, microscopy that we found were good fits to the kind of precision and the kind of information that we need to get from these recordings. So the first one we call 2D imaging. It's essentially the same thing when we take a picture with a camera. It's a 2D image. We're taking a three-dimensional room and we're putting it onto a two-dimensional plane and we're collecting at every point just the intensity of the light that's impinging on the camera. We used a very special camera, scientific grade, special optics to give us the kind of resolution on the surface that we needed. We tuned the depth of field to give us the kind of probing information that we wanted, and we were able to turn the surface of a phonograph record into a picture like this. This is a tiny little fraction of a millimeter sized image, but what it's showing you is a groove that's wiggling about because of the amplitude and pitch of the sound that's recorded. The groove looks like this, so that's the 75 microns that we talked about over here. The light is impinging on the surface in such a way that it's all perpendicular to the surface. It's an optical trick. But what that does is anything that's flat gives us a nice signal back up into the optics. Anything that's not sends the light off in some other direction. So you get this very, very high contrast image where edges are brought out in pretty beautiful detail. And offensive things like dust particles and scratches are also very, very easy to see. Okay, and when you image a surface in this way, if you have sufficient resolution, the sampling in the time direction that you end up achieving is equivalent to greater than 100 kilohertz, which is way beyond the audio regime and you know, meets requirements that people recognize for high-frequency sampling of audio. And the kind of cameras that you can use for this allow near real-time imaging, not real-time, but maybe two or three times slower than real-time. You can scan an entire surface and get very detailed information, and you can extract information about how the groove is moving from these very, very high contrast edges. And you can see I applied one of those algorithms, the 8 times every pixel minus the ones around it, and you can see that it tosses almost everything out and turns it black except these very, very important edges where the audio information is stored. So this is edge detection, it's called. It's a very widely used technique in image processing. It's extremely fast, and it can be tuned to work really well on this kind of data. Now, if you remember, we were talking about the phonograph record and the cylinder. I told you that on a cylinder, the groove actually moves up and down, not side to side. So side to side, this kind of technique is okay. You can capture the information because it's in a plane. But for three dimensions, you need another approach. And so here, this is supposed to indicate one of the cylinders again, and this little white line is the helix. And what we're trying to find out at every point is not the excursion in the plane, but the depth. So a regular camera is not a good way to measure depth, right? if I took a picture of this room by context, I could say you're behind him, she's behind you, and a person is so big, so it must be 2 feet or something like that. But if you want precision information about depth, you have to use a different technique. And so the technique that we looked at, a whole bunch of three-dimensional imaging techniques, but the one that emerged was a form of what's called confocal microscopy. This is a technique for three-dimensional imaging, which is widely used in fields like biology, but also for quality control on precision devices. All the iPhones have their front panels scanned and tested using confocal microscopy. The way it works, well, there are many different ways to do it, but the way we, the technique that we ended up using was to use what's called a color-coded confocal microscope. What it does is it takes a source of light, which is white, puts it through a pinhole, and then through a lens. Now, this is not just a regular lens. It's a lens that has a very exaggerated chromatic aberration, so it disperses the different colors. Normally, you don't want a lens to do that because it'll mess up your picture. But in this case, it's one of these turning of vice into a virtue. You see the different colors of light come into focus at different depths along the optical axis, right? So this loci of foci is really useful, because if you can tell which color is in focus on a surface, you can infer the depth of that surface. And that's what's shown here. You've got these three different wavelengths, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, are in focus at different depths, and there's an object passing through there, and because the magenta happens to be the one that's in focus, and the confocal microscope can collect some of the reflected light, and by using a spectrograph, it can tell which color is in focus. It can find the depth on a point. And the point that it images is only a couple of microns in diameter. And these are commercial devices that work extremely fast. You can collect several thousand measurements a second, and these things run with as many as 200 points in parallel on a comb. So you can scan these across a surface and very efficiently and very quickly measure the surface. And that's exactly what's done here, scanning across the surface of the cylinder. This is an image that the confocal microscope gives us where it looks like a photograph, but it's actually a depth image. So if it's dark, it's deep, and if it's light, it's high. So if we look across this red line and we ask what's the depth as a function of position on this line, you can see it's deep, up. And so these are grooves, and this is the time direction. This is a sound recording in depth. And by taking a whole series of these images and then mathematically analyzing these shapes, we can actually get at the sound that's stored, as long as we can do it with sufficient resolution to be sensitive to these minute scales that characterize these recordings. And just, you know, pictorially, what we're doing in the case of the disk is where, you know, at a certain point along this spiral trajectory, we are associating the movement of in this 2D image, and at a certain point along the time direction, we have a certain measurement of the depth. And really, that's it. Once you've got this information, it becomes a very long just list of numbers: time, depth, or time. Time excursion. It just goes on, very large number. And then it's almost arithmetic to do the kind of calculations and reformatting that eventually turns this into an audio file that you can actually listen to. Now, in practice, lots of software and, you know, handling big files and getting it all straightened out. And of course, there are, you know, a whole shopping list of technical issues that you have to deal with. You have to keep the focus in control over this large, relatively large surface. If the system is vibrating, you know, because they're hammering on the building or because, you know, things are in the HVAC, that has to be controlled. Your illumination systems have to have sufficient brightness and have to be very, very stable, because if they're flickering on and off at some high frequency, that ends up disturbing the measurement. You have to align the system, calibrate the system. You have to efficiently acquire and log the data. But these are all things that experimental physics people kind of do day in and day out. So if you throw that whole toolkit at all of this, you find that you can actually build a system of hardware and software to accomplish this. And so we did that. And this is kind of what it looks like in one of its incarnations. And we named it Irene. The reason we named it Irene was because the very first recording that we tried this out on when we were first just messing around with parts around the lab was a recording of Goodnight Irene, which was a Leadbelly song. It was actually a recording by the Weavers. And you know, that song, Goodnight Irene, a lot of children think it's like a little lullaby you sing before bed and stuff like that. But it really reads like, you know, when you see like a show on HBO and it says, you know, sexual content, violence, murder, you know, all the things, so you know what you're watching. So that song is like adultery, suicide, drugs, and murder, okay? That's what the song is actually about. So don't play it for your children, okay? But the system, okay, it contains a confocal microscope, a 2D imaging system, turntables and spindles for rotating cylinders and discs, lots of hardware to back it all up, vibration isolation, and so forth. And now there's about 6 or 7 of these machines in various places that are using them in various audio preservation and access projects. And to show you the kind of information that we end up getting from the data that a system like this is capable of collecting, this is one of these three-dimensional depth images that's collected by the confocal microscope. This is off the surface of a cylinder, a wax, composed of wax, that is a historic, some kind of field recording in a collection. So this is the direction of time, and so the needle would be running along, and you see when it's dark, it's deep, and this red line is actually tracing one particular groove, and it would go all the way around and then come back here and all around and come back here. And you can see it wiggling up and down in correspondence to the sound that's been recorded, but there's some really bad things, like there's a hair, okay? So you see a big blip corresponding to the presence of that hair. It's also this kind of wispy-looking stuff. That's actually a mold that eats wax and can damage the recordings. And so you can see now a lot of detail just from the assessment point of view about the condition that this thing is in. But there are algorithms that we can now apply from an image processing, from a data processing perspective that allow us to actually, if you notice the orange detail here, that's the computer saying, I found all of these things that don't look like they're supposed to be there, according to some rules that we gave the computer for analyzing this image. And then you can actually subtract them off and smooth over those regions, and you can get a cleaned up version of the recording, which it hasn't found missing information, but it has made it more listenable, which may be an advantage in certain applications. Okay? So we've talked a lot about how we got to this and how all of these things work. So it's now appropriate to listen to some examples of these things and talk about the benefits or the bad sides of this process. Okay? So I'm gonna start off by playing kind of 3 examples. So the first example is we got a record made for us which just had tones on it, just simple tones, right? So it sounds like this. So the point of this was that the engineer who created this record for us, he recorded many different tones in a systematic way up to about 15,000 cycles per second, which kind of starts to pass out from where most people can even hear. And the point of this measurement was to show that by scanning this, the tones that his name was George, the tone that George recorded in purple and the tones that Irene reproduced in yellow were in good correspondence. So that's a kind of basic calibration that you're kind of doing the right thing. Okay. He also recorded for us some content, and so here's the content. I see the moon horizon. Okay. So, Creedence. Turns out George was the guy who actually recorded Creedence, you know, back in the day at Fantasy Studios in Berkeley, California, and so he had this right on his server. And this was not played with a needle, it was actually scanned and gone through this entire process that we just described. So now, folks from the Montana State Historical Society, they brought us this wax cylinder from 1906, which was broken. And it was from inside this fortune teller mechanism. So you'd put money in and it would it would pick different things to play and you would be able to listen to it. And so it would tell your fortune. So this is what it sounded like.
You will soon go to a ball or large gathering and meet a new friend. A sincere friend seeks to help you in matters of importance to you. Your troubles can be avoided by changing your attitude towards them. You will have unexpected good fortune in a letter. The first years of your life will be the unhappiest. You will be married 3 times, each time more happily. A person who has made trouble for you in the past will become your friend.
Right, so you laughed, so you obviously could hear the thing about the marriage. It's interesting, you know, how much this would probably apply to people in a rock band. The thing is, I've kind of taken you to two extremes, right? I've shown you something in pristine condition, and I've shown you something in pretty bad condition. And this kind of gives you a plausibility argument that this technique, you know, can bring some value to these materials. Is it better or worse than the standard playback? Because the standard playback is cheap. I didn't tell you how much all this stuff cost and how many years we spent developing it, but it's not inexpensive. It's not something you can just ignore. So there isn't a single answer to this. The optical approach that I've been describing, it can render a whole range, and I will show you now, of unplayable materials playable for the first time. Delicate and damaged materials are better imaged. That, I believe, is a best practice that people are adopting. This applies to materials made of wax, lacquer, acetate, and other archaic materials. On the other hand, shellac disc recordings, which are hundreds of thousands of commercial releases, 3 minutes long on 78 RPM discs, if those are in good condition, the traditional methods work just fine. And I don't think there's a strong argument that you need, unless it's figuring into some workflow, that you need to do this. But however, these optical methods, which allow you to do numerical analysis on the data, introduce a whole bunch of new elements that can give you additional advantages and lead to noise reduction and restoration when it's appropriate. And I'll take you through some of that. Okay? So this picture is supposed to kind of point to some of the advantages graphically applied to these materials. So one thing is these 12 pictures are different materials, different kinds of recordings that were created over the years on wax, on foil, on metal, on lacquer, on shellac. And these are all pictures of different recordings that have actually been scanned and restored using this technique. So they're not just random pictures. So it handles a great diversity of materials like a Xerox machine. It doesn't care, right, what it is. It's also highly data-driven, so we get a tremendous amount of redundant information about the surface, and that allows us to invoke a lot of different mathematical approaches. It's non-invasive, so things that are breaking apart, broken already, which are absolutely unplayable or you wouldn't want to touch, you can still scan and digitally reassemble them. And it's a totally dynamical free method. There's no moving parts, if you like. And this is a picture from a paper from around 1930, which explored fundamental limitations to phonograph records in the way that Edison was recording them in the vertical modulation. And what it's showing is that if the stylus gets too big relative to the surface undulation, it no longer properly describes the surface anymore, but it creates a distortion, which is called a tracing distortion. There were many papers written about this and a lot of analysis that went on all the way into the 1960s. The optical technique totally avoids this problem because the effective stylus is so small compared to an actual stylus that you no longer have to worry about any kind of tracing distortion. Okay? And as a demonstration of that, here's another picture showing that as the undulations of the surface increase in frequency, in wavelength, decrease in wavelength, for a fixed stylus size, you start to run to a point where you no longer can capture it. And this is a stylus playback, and this is frequency, and above a few thousand hertz, the amplitude is falling off really fast because the stylus can no longer trace the surface undulations, whereas the optical playback of the same material just continues on in what we call a flat transfer out to a much higher frequency. And you can hear that, right? So first I'm going to play this stylus version. Okay, and that is this waveform here, which looks pretty and nice and smooth and clean. But instead, if we play it optically, so you would say it's brighter, and that's because it's capturing more of the high frequencies, and that's borne out by all this fine structure. Now, some of that is actually noise and scratches and dust, but that's good, because by capturing all that information, we have the options to deal with it mathematically, and that is a better place to be. It's a you're preserving the material, and you now have options about what to do. Okay. Now, you can take this a little bit further and actually do a noise restoration on it. And so this is a cylinder. Here, time is going in this direction, down, up, and so forth. And you can see this random-looking stuff. That's the effect of the mold that we talked about earlier. And that mold is contributing high-frequency content, and when it when the stylus passes through the mold, you're going to hear a crunching sound. But in an optical playback, and this is a Native American field recording, you're going to see a lot of that ends up getting removed. So here we go. Oops. Okay, so that crunching sound is because the mold is localized, and so every time it goes around and passes through the mold, you hear this crunching sound instead. So you can see that now that's been dramatically suppressed through this restorative process because we have this information. Okay, so the last example in this part of the talk that I want to show you is broken media. So I'm going to play you something. It's just going to sound like a recording of an old song, but it was a record that was actually this record broken into this many pieces.
Silly ditty, you can sing it right away. Now here is what you say, so sing it while you may.
Okay, so by the way, it's called the Too Fat Polka, and it's very offensive, so I just cut it off before we got to that. But to actually deal with something that's broken, there's a lot of mechanical issues that get invoked, because once something breaks, the pieces are free, and they start changing microscopically. They warp differently, and so to gather data from a broken object is a whole other challenge, and we've actually had a lot of students work on different aspects of capturing data from this badly behaving kind of collection of materials. So it's actually a really interesting problem. It's related to reassembling pottery and other things, right? Okay, so in the kind of last part of the talk, I want to just take you through the kind of collections that we've been able to or are now addressing with this technique, and hopefully I hope we're making contributions. So I told you that we have this great partnership with the Library of Congress. It's continuing on, and from that it led to further collaboration with many other institutions like the National Archives and Smithsonian and others, and this kind of led to a whole development of tools to enable us to use this in an efficient way to create workflows, to handle large collections, to make the software fast and robust so that it can just day in and day out, people can just put stuff on these machines. Since 2015, at the Northeast Document Conservation Center, which is near Boston, they have an entire IRENE suite of tools, and so people are bringing them, dozens and dozens of different collections come in, and they scan them, restore them, and return them to Harvard, Duke, Middlebury, you know, just a whole bunch of different institutions. And we've been asked and been able to work with a number of important museums and collections to tease out the early history of sound recording technology through artifacts that were, up till now, were never considered playable, and essentially have now rendered playable an example of almost all the historic milestones in pre-1895 development of recorded sound. So between Edison's 1877, or even the Leon Scott 1860, And let's say the mid-1890s, when commercial recording started to become available to the public, we've gotten access to essentially everything that anybody had or that has appeared and actually rendered it playable, and I'll show you some examples of those. And there are actually major initiatives underway now to digitize complete collections using this technique. So the first area of this is what I'll call field recording, or it's called field recordings. These are recordings where people took recording equipment out into the field and recorded in some situ people in their daily life, in their circumstances. And the names and faces on here are some of the people that really made important contributions to early field recording. Jesse Fuchs, he was the first person to do a field recording, which was in 1890 up in Maine. Alfred Kroeber at the University of California at Berkeley, Francis Densmore in the Plains, Milman Perry, actually important recordings we're going to talk about in a minute in Yugoslavia, Mary Haas in the Southeast, John Harrington in the Southwest, Melville Jacobs here in the Northwest, and Franz Boas in Canada. So these are a few of the people, but who had this tremendous insight and vision to take recording out into the field and do this. So we had the opportunity beginning in 2011, 2012, both on the Boas recordings that Ethie talked about, and with several dozen of the Kroeber recordings at the University of California, to do a kind of pilot study and figure out, you know, whether you could systematically digitize in a fixed way, in a controlled way. And Mary Rose Berrios was a physics major at Berkeley who worked for years on this project, kind of figuring out how to do this, documenting it, and taking all this data. Well, in 2014, this became a project at UC Berkeley called Linguistic and Ethnographic Sound Recordings from Early 20th Century California, Optical Scanning, Digitization, and Access, which was a collaboration between the Department of Linguistics, the Phoebe Hearst Museum of Anthropology, the UC Libraries, and Berkeley Lab, funded generously by NSF, the NEH, and the University of California, which was, let's say, okay, let's do it. 3 years, digitize all 3,000 recordings in the Berkeley collection. And this is underway, and to an important extent, thanks to Olivia Dill, who was another Berkeley undergraduate, who kind of built a whole workflow that enabled us to undertake this project. And to do it, we had to build a special version of Irene, which is kind of like a shish kebab. We could put up to 5 cylinders on a system at once and scan 24/7, well, 24/5.5, really, but because we can't, for security reasons, we're not allowed to leave it running over the weekend. But basically, this is a highly automated system that has now taken us through 2,500 cylinders to date, just scanning. And there's a staff of people and an army of students that have participated in the collection and the archiving and the handling and the analysis of all this data. Just a couple of examples. California and the whole West Coast has an amazing diversity of Native American languages, much more than the rest of the country in some metric. And you can speculate, you know, climate or other reasons why that is. But each of these regions here is a different language. Okay, so for example, right, and so now there's essentially an entire digital archive of these through this scanning process, and it will complete this summer. So looking for another collection that wants to be scanned, we know there are other ones out there. With Harvard University, we've been studying Milman Perry's recordings, 3,000 aluminum discs. We don't have a full-scale project to do these yet, but 3,000 discs, 6,000 sides. Okay, so it's a lot of recordings. He lugged this early electrical recording system in the early 1930s around what you would sort of call Yugoslavia. And he recorded singers who only sung in an oral tradition and only knew the material through an oral tradition, and his goal was not just to collect folklore, but to understand how the oral tradition actually works technically. How does somebody learn a piece of music, a poem that goes on for hours and hours? And he and his students discovered something which became the oral formulaic hypothesis of Western literature, which is that there are structures within these songs, within these poems, that give the man or the woman a way of remembering how to repeat things, where things show up, timing, juxtaposition. And it was then shown that the same structures could be found in epic poetry of the classical era. So this was a breakthrough in somehow using empirical data to show that the classical poetry of Homer and others had to have come from an oral tradition, because it was using the same techniques that these contemporary bards were using in Yugoslavia at the time. And so just to give you a taste of what these things sound like. Okay, all right. So now I'd like to move to the early history of the sound recording technology. That's kind of the last example I'm going to give you. So in 1880, Alexander Graham Bell was reacting to Thomas Edison, his competitor's invention of 1877, and he establishes something called the Volta Laboratory in Washington, D.C. to conduct signals research, Bell Labs, right? He forms an association with his cousin Chichester Bell and an instrument builder from Boston called Charles Sumner Tainter. And these people, over about a five-year period, they experiment with an astounding variety of materials and formats, and a number of patents emerge from that, leading eventually to the wax cylinder. And these are pictures of just a variety of different recordings on materials and shapes and sizes that these people studied. And all of this stuff is in the Smithsonian. So Smithsonian came to us around 2012 and said, let's try and apply optical scanning and see if we can. We've never heard any of these things, right? So the gold, you know, the golden nugget that came out of this was a uniquely identified recording of some 400 items of Alexander Graham Bell himself speaking. And I'm going to play a snippet of it. It goes on for many, many minutes, and it's mostly him reciting various numbers and dollars and cents values, which probably was something about, you know, how would this be able to be used commercially? But in the end, he identifies himself and where and when he made this recording. So let's listen to Bell. Oops. Got to get it just right.
This record has been made by Alexander Graham Bell in the presence of Dr. Christopher A. Bell on the 16th of April, 1885, at the Volta Laboratory, 1251 Connecticut Avenue, Washington, D.C., in Whitney, Florida, you are now home. Alexander Graham Bell.
Okay, did you all hear that? Good. Okay, and you can see how bad the condition of this record is. It's delaminating, it's cracking and falling apart. Now, just to show you kind of how wild these guys were, they developed a sound recording machine that was purely based on light. Okay, everybody else was using grooves. They took a disc of glass, covered it with a photographic emulsion, and built a system where they could modulate a beam of light that came from the sun by yelling at it. And this modulation was then photographically captured, okay? And this approach, 40 years later, becomes the optical variable density optical film soundtrack that, you know, many of you, when you heard analog film optical soundtracks, you know, that's the way it was done. But this is an actual machine, and the way they modulated sound is they sprayed a jet of liquid across an aperture, and they caused that jet to modulate by speaking, okay? So very creative. And interesting thing about this recording is it starts in the middle and spirals outwards, and then it stops. And you can see that black splotch, that's because it gets overexposed, right? And we think that this liquid spraying mechanism failed at that moment because they suddenly stop and say an extremely bad word, like right at the moment, you know, corresponding to all of this, okay? Then they restart, and the interesting thing is, and you find this all over Bell's recordings, is they very often will trill. So they'll go, brrrp, okay? And that to us maybe was a kind of testing 1, 2, 3. It was a fixed sound that they could hope to reproduce over and over again. But the interesting thing is that this trill is starting as the record is speeding up, so it's actually chirped. And if you guys were at the conference today and you heard about gravitational radiation, the signal from colliding black holes is a chirp, okay? So these guys were like colliding black holes back in the 1880s. Okay, so let's listen to the bad word. Okay. All right. And then sorry for if there are any children here. Okay. Anyway, and here's the trill. Which is trill. Okay. Okay. So the final recording that I want to play for you, I want to go back all the way, you know, to the beginning, right? So this is Edward Leon Scott de Martinville's phonautograph of 1860. And it's this tracing on soot-coated paper that we talked about. Along the edge of this paper, he scratches in French some notes. So this is like the world's first liner notes. And what he does, and what he's explaining here, is that he simultaneously recorded the voice and a tuning fork that was directly inscribing at the same time. And so what he did by recording a tuning fork in contemporary with the voice was he provides a measurement of the speed of the recording, okay? Which, if you think about it, no one had ever recorded sound before. No one had even thought about it. And this guy figures out that he needs to have a time base. That's pretty good, okay? Yeah. And he wasn't even American. Okay. So what it says here is Au clair de la lune, translated, Au clair de la lune, sung, the pitch is measured by the tuning fork of 500 vibrations per second, which writes directly and simultaneously in interlinear space of the song. So Au clair de la lune is a little French folk song. Just to remind you of what it sounds like, this is a contemporary recording of it. Okay, so this is going to be a lot slower. Right, so that's the first earliest recognizable recording of a human voice. Scott has experiments that precede this, but nothing that captured the voice in a way that we can identify as this is a human being. So this is really kind of where it begins. So just in wrapping up, future directions, we've got this transfer project in Berkeley, and there are several other ones that I hope will come up, perhaps the Volta Laboratory Collection, the Harvard Collection. You know, these are under discussions. We're also talking with international colleagues. We have one system that's already deployed internationally, and there's interest from the Moscow Conservatory. They'd like to put a system in Russia, other places where there are at-risk recorded sound collections. Obviously, we're continuing to work on the tools and the software. We're very interested in physical modeling methods to get deeper understanding of how a stylus actually interacts with a real surface. Studies of how to standardize optical scanning as a practice, the development of a user community, and open sourcing of the code. So let me leave you with just a thought. What if? So sound recording in the 19th century, it utilizes these fairly crude mechanical technologies and methods, which if you really think about it, they could have been applied much earlier. I mean, somebody could have invented sound recording before Leon Scott de Martinville or Edison. They didn't need anything that had yet to be invented to do this. So my favorite person is, what about Leonardo da Vinci? I mean, If Leonardo da Vinci had done this in the 1400s or 1500s, you know, this talk would go on for 3 hours because we'd listen to George Washington and all these other people, but you don't want that. Okay. But the interesting thing about da Vinci, and I found this in an exhibit of da Vinci's work, because I was walking through and I was saying, why didn't you do this, Leonardo? Leonardo wrote in what's called the Treatise on Painting that poetry and music are inferior to sculpture and painting because hearing is less noble than sight, in that as it is born, it dies, and its death is as swift as its birth. So he was just obsessed with the transient nature of sound. And he thought if God thought it was important, he would have, you know, figured out a way to make it permanent. And what da Vinci missed is that God wanted him to do that. You know, he could have done that, you know, but he didn't do it, and he kind of blew it. So da Vinci ends up on the dustbin of history, and he could have, you know, done something. Okay. Anyway, I have to thank all of these generous institutions that have given us support and enabled this work to continue over the past whatever years. Berkeley Lab, my home institution, the Library of Congress. We have a great collaboration with the University of Applied Sciences in Fribourg, Switzerland. Otar Johnson sends us students every year to work on this Smithsonian Institution. And something like 40 students have worked on aspects of this project. Here you can see all their happy faces. It's a great way of exposing students from physics, EE, and the STEM fields to problems in preservation and conservation, which have a scientific or technical aspect to them. Today's digital technology, I hope I gave a good argument, provides a window on the entire early period of sound recording and its rich research, artistic, historical, and commercial legacies. Bill Viette is the director of the Northeast Document Conservation Center, where we've got a system, and he says, your ultimate audience is posterity. And I always like that. Irene.lbl.gov is the project website. There are a bunch of links there. And the National Recording Preservation Board is a much bigger entity that deals with the whole issue of recorded sound preservation. And if it's something that interests you, I encourage you to consult the Library of Congress. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carl, for this beautiful talk. So we can have a couple of Q&A sessions.
Sure.
I understand that there was a piece of pottery found from antiquity that appears to have something that looks like a stylus dragged through recording audio. Have you heard about that? Do you know anything about it?
Okay, so I do not know about this specific discovery that you're alluding to. There is a general topic, which is called archaeoacoustics, and it's the idea that sound may have been, let's say, accidentally recorded in antiquity or before Leon Scott de Martinville, and that somehow if we found the piece of pottery that somebody was spinning with a little stylus to create a pattern when somebody in the other room was yelling, you know, the pasta's ready or whatever, you know, that we would have captured that. This question I've been asked dozens of times, okay? And, you know, call in radio show and all sorts of things, emails. And we've thought about it, and yeah, it would be an amazing discovery, right? But I'm very skeptical that this actually ever happened, because if you actually look at how deliberately Leon Scott de Martinville and Edison had to be to deal with impedances and compliance and find the right materials, I don't find it very plausible. And the interesting thing about nature is that, well, nature does provide you with phenomena that have time, that somehow encode time, but you'd need to encode time, you know, at the almost the microsecond, several tens of microsecond time scale. And there are not many natural processes that leave us a record of things happening over those times. You go to Zion National Park, you can see time encoded in the walls over millions of years. But it's very hard to find a place where nature gave us a really high frequency time base. So I don't think so.
Okay, just gonna wait a second.
Hi, I'm curious if the source file is a limit to the audio quality we're hearing, or if digital processing in the future will render something like you're actually there?
I mean, there's no one simple answer to that question. There are definitely restorative things that can be done, and noise restoration. There are noise restoration features here that deal with the image itself, which is kind of where the noise is coming from. And then there are noise restoration features that are generally known that can deal with a waveform. So there are definitely things that can be done to do more noise restoration. And beyond that, when you really want to say, let's get back to the room, if you like, that starts to be what I was referring to when I talked about physical modeling. Like, if you could really build models of the horns and the speaker systems and the linkages and the diaphragms, you could start to unfold the transfer process that went on. But we've mused about that. We've talked about it at times. And it's something we dabble in a little bit, but not we don't have a strong statement or result on that. But it's an interesting question.
I'm not complaining.
Okay, thank you.
Are the discs or cylinders spinning when you're taking the pictures of them? And if so, how do you hold the fragments together for the ones that are breaking up?
Okay, so yes, they are spinning. And so there are a number of different ways to hold things together. You can put first of all, they don't spin very fast. So the problem of, okay, is typically not an issue. But we have basically retaining rings that can hold the disc together if we need to. In the case of cylinders, I didn't really have time to deal with it today, but we've actually developed a mandrel that has vacuum. And so we can actually suck the broken pieces of a cylinder together and hold it on the mandrel. And the mandrel is 3D printed. And I actually have a really nice picture of the 3D printer in the Berkeley makerspace printing this 3D mandrel with all hundreds of vacuum holes in it. And so, yeah, and the 3D guys at Berkeley were really excited about it. They made a little movie of it and so forth. So yeah, there's ways to do this. Yeah. Somebody in the back, right? to be fair, I guess. Okay,
so I have two questions. One is, it sounds like you have Irene in Berkeley or the Berkeley environs and around Boston. Are there any Irenes in this area or elsewhere? And the other thing is, a lot of the energy has gone in to just being able to get the recordings. How much energy is going into cleaning them up so you can get rid of as many pops and scratches as they have on them?
Okay, so as I said, there's 6 or 7 machines. There are a couple at the Library of Congress. There's a couple in Berkeley at Northeast Document Conservation Center. And there's one in Chennai. In India, long story. Okay, so those are the machines. So there's nothing in the Pacific Northwest, but you know we're definitely open to collaborating with institutions that would be interested. It's a cost benefit thing. It's do you invest in this infrastructure for a limited collection, or do you take your collection to the Northeast Document Conservation Center, et cetera. So when you say effort. So like in the Berkeley scanning project, the scanner runs day and night, and then we have a person on staff and also students who are constantly analyzing the data. And we have a bunch of knobs that we use to do various levels of restoration. So we always create unrestored files that we call raw, and then more access-oriented files upon which we apply filters or cleanup. And so there's a certain amount, probably 20% of the analysis effort goes into some aspect of restoration. And then, all our students that are doing more like analytical projects are typically working on noise reduction algorithms that bring in different techniques. So we have always a few students in the summer and a handful of students during the school term, and they work on aspects of noise reduction typically. In the back. Yeah,
so thank you for this talk. It's really interesting to hear. I have two questions. First, how much of the bad audio quality is caused by the recording, and how much is the degradation of time? And for the second question, how much of the analysis is done manually, and how much is done automatically afterwards?
Okay, so The first question is, early sound recordings have typically a very limited bandwidth because the recording mechanisms that they used, which were acoustic, just because of mass and shapes of horns and things, you know, ends up several hundred hertz on the low side and a couple thousand on the high side. So you're just dead outside of those regions. The stuff is just didn't get captured, okay? You can play with the edges of that a little bit and boost it up if you want to in the sense of an equalization. But you know, you're not getting out to 10,000 hertz on a very old recording. Beyond that, if the recording is in, let's say, very pristine condition, you know, the audio quality isn't bad. It typically was not recorded at a very fixed speed, so there's some speed variation. These are things that can be corrected in software. But most of these recordings, most of the objects that we end up with have been mistreated or badly stored or fall apart and are rough. And the what we do know is that the noise that you hear is the surface quality. It's not that the optical scanning process is adding its own noise to that process, to these distressed recordings, because we know from studies that we've done that the noise that the optical scanning adds is far below the baseline set by the material itself. So in some uncorrelated sense, it's irrelevant, okay? Beyond that, I would say, I don't have a number for you, but I would say that the quality is mostly because the recordings have not fared well, okay? Then the other question was, remind me? Oh, okay. So the analysis tools at this point are very sophisticated. Huge amount of code has been written. So we can take an optical scan of an entire cylinder, which has hundreds of revolutions going around it, and it's several gigabytes of data, and we can put it into this code, and it'll automatically trace the trajectory of the groove without any human intervention in 90-something percent of the cases. If it's cracked or broken, we have interactive tools that we can use to steer it or correct it, you know, almost like video games. You can fly through the grooves and stuff like that. So there are plenty of tools that we can invoke if we need to, but largely it's not necessary. Now, we have certain presets that we use for setting like thresholds for what's noise and what's signal and things like that. And one of the things that we're very interested in is automating those features, like making it analyze the data and then find where it should set its levels. And these almost kind of dabbles into machine learning or AI-ish kind of things. And so when we talk about student projects and things looking towards the future, you know, we have ideas along those lines. But for the Phoebe Hearst, the 2,500 cylinders that we've done, it's largely, I would say, an automated process. Although we have everybody listening, we have the students and the worker listening to everything that comes out as a quality assurance step. Okay? So.
Okay. Perhaps we can have two more questions. Okay. So we can have one in the front, one in the back.
When you scan a phonograph record, are you scanning it linearly or are you unraveling the spiral?
Okay, so what happens, I think even a slide that shows this. Okay, so what happens is the camera that we use to image it is a line scan camera, all right? So it's unlike, you know, the camera that we have in our phones and so forth, which is an area, it's just one line of pixels, say 4,000 pixels, okay? And those 4,000 pixels are aligned along a radius of the disk, okay? And then the disk rotates, and the encoder in the rotation triggers the camera. So if you do the math, if this is a 78 and you trigger it 80,000 times, you get 104 kilohertz of time sampling, okay? So what that does, like you said, is it takes the spiral and it unwinds it into a rectangle, all right? Okay? And so that kind of looks like this, right? And then this data, an algorithm finds the minimum, if you like, and traces it along there, and then applies an edge detection algorithm to the where the information is. Once you've done that, you pretty much know where everything is. The interesting thing is that wherever there are little dust particles or scratches, the edge detection finds kind of outlying points. And so we histogram the size of the groove, and anything that's in the tail we know is a scratch or a dust particle. And so that's an automatic noise detection algorithm that can then be used to clean the audio waveform up, and then we differentiate it, and then it becomes audio. So that's kind of how it works. Does that answer your question? Yeah, good. So then the other question? Hi.
So you've got all this fancy equipment to read physical things into sounds. Have you tried anything that wasn't originally intended to be a recording, or would there just be too much noise?
You mean to like find sound on just a found object of something?
Yeah, like what does a block of wood sound like or something like that?
Yeah. You know, no. Okay. So the short answer is yeah. So it was funny because this whole bunch of Russians came before Donald Trump became president. Who were really interested in this technology for musical collections, and one of them was a composer, and she just insisted on scanning a piece of wood or something. I can't remember what. So we said fine, we'll do it, right? But there was no way to uniquely track it because there was no groove. So we basically just put it through the manual analysis and we just said, follow this trajectory. And it just sounds like noise. But maybe the noise of mahogany and the noise of pine is different. You know, I don't wanna second guess an artist, right? That's a sure way to get in trouble. So yeah, I mean, I've had people inquire about this. You know, could we digitize other objects? And yeah, you could. And different objects will have different sounds, but they'll be what you might call noise. You're not going to find, you know, the secret to the Kabbalah or something in a soda can. Yeah.
What is the sound of one hand clap?
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Carl. Thanks, Carl, for giving us this wonderful night. So we are now a little bit run out of time for this room. So let's give Carl some time to pack his things. Then we can talk to Carl outside this room, and then we can try to pack everything here. So thanks for everyone coming to here.
Okay.
And thanks for everyone coming to here. Hopefully we can invite you for the future event. You also join us. Have a wonderful night. Have a nice trip home.
Okay.